Welcome to Season 2 at Disability Bandwidth,
a show where we talk with experts in disability about their journey, life, and inspiration.
I'm Nikki Nolan.
And I'm Sam Prue. Let's get started.
Would you mind introducing yourself?
My name is Julie Harris. Pronouns are she, her, and I am a female presenting brown, dark brown hair, kind of curly, wearing headphones and very messy undone curls today, rosy cheeks, and a hoodie that's kind of light pink nude kind of color.
I love that. Nude is a color. That's a new one.
nude for white, very, very fair skinned nude kind of color.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. It's amazing as someone who's sort of completely blind, how many value judgments are wrapped up in color, right? Whether it's about race or ethnicity or value or any number of these things. Anyway, that's not what we're here to talk about today. We're here to learn about you and what you do and how you got there. So first of all, what's your role? What are you up to in the space?
I am kind of do what I want when I want kind of role. I do consulting. I work with companies, corporations, but also police, hospitals, schools, training on better how to better interact and serve the disability community, and then corporations, how to go beyond just the bare minimum, or at least even meet the bare minimum legal requirements, but also go beyond that, you know, to better support employees. And then I do some work with employees and provide support for them so that they can ask for the accommodations, identify what accommodations they need, advocate for themselves confidently, you know, and figure out, understand really what their rights are. And so kind of broad things. That's overall though what I do.
But I mean, all those things are so connected, aren't they? In the kind of holistic view of what we need to do to make accessibility happen, really. Although I will say that it's super interesting. So it sounds like you're sort of more in the world of like hands-on practical physical accessibility rather than digital accessibility, right?
That is correct. And I yes, that's correct. Mm.
So, I mean, do you notice a difference? Because, I mean, I know a lot of corporations, right, are focused on like lawsuits and legal compliance and like following the checklists and stuff. Is that the same for folks like the police? Or like, do you notice a different vibe when you're kind of working in the government industry, in the public service industry, as opposed to the corporate industry?
I'm smiling and kind of chuckling a little bit as you ask that question, because it's such a good question, really, really good points, and shows anybody kind of with, I think, a lot of lived experience has in the corporate world or in these things, you know, kind of how that question shows. Anyway, I chuckled while laughing, like, because it's such a good question. But it depends what hospital, what police force, it depends, because some it really is just risk aversion and how do we comply with the laws, and some it's okay, we've seen that this is a need and we don't know how to meet it yet, and we see that we have a huge gap, so can you help us actually better serve the people that we serve?
So just for the record, I am making the assumption, and I should not, that you are speaking from an American context, and the organizations you work with are in the US, right?
Police and hospitals and stuff, yeah. Some corporations I've worked with outside of the US, that is obviously, I'm not a lawyer, so nothing that I say here or there is legal advice.
No, of course.
But a lot of the laws, even outside of the country, are very, very, very similar to the laws in the United States when it comes to disability inclusion in the workplace. So, and the Americans with Disabilities Act. So a lot of processes that I implement are just as applicable in other countries.
Yeah, of course, because once you figure out how to do it, that doing it right, once we figure it out, hopefully should be the same from country to country, right? Although of course there are going to be cultural variations and such. Although what other countries have you worked in, and have you noticed kind of differences in the way that they approach these things or the way that they respond to training and such?
There's some in Europe that are seemingly much more open, and their companies are already much more adept at accepting or accommodating various needs, whether they're disability needs or otherwise. So the work-life balance, I think, is a really big undertone that either hurts or helps the accommodation process. And here in the United States, it is very, work is priority. Even if you're sick, you know, a lot of companies kind of expect you to work depending on how sick you are and things like that. Where other companies, I mean, other countries that I've worked with in Europe, Netherlands, Germany, some, Ireland, for sure, it's a very different type of culture. And days off aren't frowned upon as I feel that they are in the United States.
Right. And too often people don't think about something like work-life balance as an accommodation, right? When you say to people accommodations, they're thinking either screen readers or wheelchairs, right? That's like, right. That's where they're at. That's right. Where they're at. Hey, but as I'm wont to do, I have taken us way off the script and dived right in because that seems to be my role being a force of chaos. No, I'm kidding. Nikki, why don't I turn it over to you to actually bring us a little bit back onto our track?
I'm going to bring us back. So I would love to know, what lights a fire in you? What gets you up in the morning and keeps you continuing to do this kind of work?
I live a fairly easy life. And it took a while to get here and learning my needs and stuff, but helping other people who are disabled have as easy of a life as they can. And there's some things that just can't be taken out, but there's a hell of a lot of things that can be. And so what gets me up is, you know, just helping empower others and teaching them to advocate for themselves and believe that they deserve a life that others can have, you know, that maybe doesn't seem attainable to them, but helping people believe that they can deserve it and attain it.
So, you sort of said that other people with a disability, right? So you identify yourself as a person with a disability and as part of this community, right?
Yes, and very much so.
So that is always interesting to me because, I mean, the next thing that we are sort of going to move into talking to is what are the key moments that led you here, right? And I think sometimes we get this assumption that, oh, well, we as people with disabilities should be working in accessibility, right? We should have a passion for this. This should be our thing, even though maybe like for some people with disabilities, it's not. And that's perfectly respectable, right? For you to be a person with a disability who's not devoting your life to accessibility, like that's, you know, that's fine. And so I'm interested sort of what moved you from just being a person with a disability, doing your own thing and making life better for yourself and kind of got you into doing this work full time.
Recognizing, and from day one, when I get into the story, it'll make sense. But from day one, obviously, I had very, very, very clear privileges. But when I realized that the life that I live as a person with a disability is very, very not the norm, but it can be, you know, and obviously not in every way, because not everybody's exactly who I am and not everybody has the exact family that I do and the exact situation that I do, but a lot of things can be. And so that's my driver to make it not just, you know, go out and do program management, which is kind of what my brain naturally does and works in. And I could make a lot of money there, but am I ever really going to feel fulfilled there if I see the vast difference in how the majority of people with disabilities are treated and in the life that they live as opposed to mine, you know? And the answer is no. So that's why I'm in this.
Yeah, maybe it's a little bit about learning not to settle, right? Because in the community, we tend to do that sometimes.
Oh, yes. And we think that we have to, and we're told that we have to, and we're told that we should be grateful for settling. And so it's not even that we feel like we have to settle, but we're told to, and we're even told that if we don't settle, we're ungrateful, you know? So
Yeah. It's so true.
Was there any like books or media or events that really were pivotal for you or shaped any key moments that led you to here?
There's a lot of books that I love and things like that. But the pivotal moment for me was I had a brain injury when I was 20. And the brain injury resulted in me being in the hospital for a few months. And the doctors, you know, telling my family they're not sure what the outcome will be, but I'll likely. And then at the end, you know, when the outcome looked more defined, saying that I would likely need 24-hour supervision. And I had great insurance through my dad. still at the time. So everything was covered. And if it wasn't covered, I'm sure my dad paid for it. To this day, I don't even know what he paid for because it never fell on me. You know, the financial aspects of that never fell on me. After the brain injury, I had seizures that were a result from the brain injury. I forgot everything. So the whole first 20 years of my life, I forgot. I had to relearn how to walk, to read, to write the alphabet. I could say the alphabet backwards for some weird reason, you know, because our brains are weird, but I couldn't say it forward and I couldn't tie a letter to what it looked like in a book. And so I had to relearn how to sound words out, but also strange, I could read words and I could identify words if I had already learned them before. So it was brain is a very weird thing. Anyway, so after that brain injury, instead of needing 24-hour care from nurses and things like that, I got it from my family because two parents who were still together and one who made enough money and had great insurance and one who stayed at home. And then a lot of siblings who were older than me who I could stay at their house as well and they could provide care for me. So during that time, I would go between one sister for 2 days, another sister's house for 2 days, and my parents' house for 3 days and do that cycle every week for, I don't know, 6 to 8 months or so. And this was the most empowering time because my needs were what mattered the most. If I needed the lights off because my head hurt, I got the lights off because my head hurt. If I needed people to stop talking because it was too loud, they stopped talking because it was too loud. If I needed medicine, I got medicine. If I needed certain food, I got certain food. I couldn't taste, so I went by texture and how things felt in my body, but I got whatever I asked for. And to me, that's so normal. You know, it's so normal to get my needs met because at that time, my family wanted me to be the best that I could be, right? They're happy that I'm alive at this point. And so they wanted me to have the best that I could. Nobody told me, no, that need doesn't matter. No, you don't actually need that food. No, you don't actually need the light off. No, you don't actually need to go to this place right now. No, you don't actually, like, I would even just tell people to leave the room. You know, no, I don't want you in here. I need you to leave the room. And nobody questioned it. So I got my needs met without question. Family supported me to be whoever I wanted to be. And again, you know, to them, it's just they're grateful that I'm even alive, but nobody knew what my future would look like. So anyway, I later learned that it's very, very, very obvious that people are taught to not listen to their needs as children, especially people with disabilities, and their needs don't matter unless it's a life risking kind of need. And, you know, especially people who are neurodiverse or who have even physical disabilities that are apparent, if your need related to that isn't obvious, then you learn to shut it down. You learn to keep it quiet. You learn to figure it out on your own. You learn to not say it because other people are either going to tell you that it's not real or they're going to judge you for it or they're going to see you as needy for it. And I was never seen as any of those things. And if I was, my family didn't let it on. You know, I never felt bad for needing after my brain injury. I never felt like I didn't deserve to feel comfortable. I never felt like I didn't deserve to have my needs met. And quite frankly, it gave me this entitlement to getting my needs met, which I think everyone deserves. Everyone should feel entitled to get their needs met because then they speak it. They're more assertive in confident ways that, okay, and if you don't meet my needs, then I'm just going to leave or I'm going to figure out something else because this is right. Anyway, that's more than books or movies or anything. It was that experience.
And it's so interesting in a few ways. I mean, first of all, as you're saying these things, it also occurs to me, how do we define need, right? Like, there seems to be this idea that, like, oh, well, if you're eating regularly and not actively dying, then your needs have been met, right? But, like, we need pleasure and friendship and entertainment and love and all of these other things, right? When you're thinking about this, how do you define need?
That's a really good question. It's something that I work with individuals on, and it's different for every person, but I, you know, this is a really interesting specific question because I guess an absolute need are those things that just keep you alive and keep you as a human, you know, functioning. Yeah. But I would go further to say that a need is anything to keep you functioning at your best, at your optimal. Mm-hmm. And anything that does that is a need to me. And I think that everyone should view it that way. As long as it doesn't hurt others, which I don't think any need does hurt others, but sometimes, I mean, maybe it'll hurt somebody's feelings, but that's not the same, you know, obviously with that caveat, and if it is going to affect others, then thinking about how to get both needs met at the same time. But I think a need is anything that helps you to be your best self, functioning at your best, your body function, your body, your brain, everything functioning at its best.
Yeah. And I just wanted to focus on that, right? Because I think there has been a sort of moving of the road markers, right, in the disability community, where need literally is defined as like just the thing that keeps you living,
right,
in some cases. And I mean, the second thing that really resonated with me as you're telling that story is the family support. I also come from that privilege of two parents together, and myself being blind, my father also being blind, I got to have a role model who got it. And I mean, look at where I am today, right? And how do we? I'm sure you've thought of this, right? Not everybody has that privilege of an incredible family. And how do we build a society that can make it easier for folks to be on equal footing if they didn't have some of the greatest families in the world and some friends and that kind of that help as they started their journey?
Such a good question. And this one is one of those that could, if we got the whole world to think about this question and the answer and how to best implement it, then the world would be so different for the disabled community, but also just for everyone in general. But I think that it's to stop seeing needs tied to disability as special needs, because they're not. They're human needs. Everyone, human, has a different needs. It's just that we're getting our needs met in different ways. And just because, you know, I have a friend who all of her food goes through her stomach, you know, goes directly through a tube in her stomach. She still needs food. It's not a special need. Mm. She needs food. She just takes it in a different way. So so the manner of getting that need met may be unique, but needs in and of themselves are not special, you know? And so it's frustrating. I think if we get rid of that, you know, all of these terms that make people feel more comfortable talking about people with disabilities and getting their needs met, like special needs and things like that. First, getting rid of that, because they're not freaking special. Stop seeing us as different. Stop acting like our needs are different than your needs. They're not. They're the same needs being met in different ways. But even then, being met in different ways, look at five people who don't have disabilities and they're getting their needs met anyway, differently. So maybe not with a tube in their stomach, but they're still choosing to eat differently. They still maybe have. Anyway, I could go on that for a while, which I will stop myself.
Right. But like, isn't it interesting that somebody has a food allergy or loathes the taste of cabbage isn't referred to as having a special need?
Or somebody who likes to use a fork rather than a spoon or never eat soup and they only like to eat certain things. And there's all of those things that we accommodate with no problem. We just say, oh, that's a little bit quirky. And then we move on from it, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Right. Mm-hmm. Right. Or cultural things, right? In different cultures, you live with your family for longer, you do things differently, or you use chopsticks, or it's just interesting that all the disability needs are special. It's also interesting that when you start talking about these things and advocating for these things and working in this area, the reactions to you and the experiences that you have can be pretty different. Nikki, I'm like trying to segue us into part two here. Why don't I let you
I would love to know what outcomes you've experienced in exploring and talking about disability.
That's interesting. There's outcomes for myself and outcomes for others. And so right after my brain injury, I didn't realize that I was different because I wasn't treated differently from my family. So I knew that I was different when I was in rehab because I was kind of like people paid different attention to me than they paid to others, you know? And obviously I was different, but my family never treated me differently in like the less than or you can't accomplish as much kind of way. You know, they never made me feel like I was really different than anybody else my age. So I went to college. My parents were incredibly supportive, even though I was having a lot of seizures at the time. And it could have been very scary. And I think most parents wouldn't have allowed their kid because it was too high of a risk. Let me go to college in a different state. And one of the scariest times of their life, they had a lot of kids and this, you know, they say it was one of the scariest times, but they let me freaking do it. And I think that's something else. Stop treating people with disabilities completely based in risk. That's a little bit of a side note. But dang, what was the question? Oh, outcomes. So also, okay, another side note. And I didn't say any of this, but after the brain injury, you know, I have seizures, but also we found a hole in my heart. I had heart surgery. I've had back surgery because of things that I was born with that we didn't discover until after the brain injury. And I am also autistic and obviously born with and didn't realize. And my family, just because they accepted all of us. Anyway, okay, that was a random side note, but just so that people know who is talking. Okay, what outcomes have I experienced in explaining my disability? So for me, and when I went to college, people just accepted me, and I didn't realize that they were treating me differently because I was so confident in who I was. I didn't even know that I needed to talk about disability in a special way. And I didn't claim myself as disabled at the time. I had seizures, sure, but that did not mean that I was disabled. You know, I wouldn't claim it. If somebody said that, I would vehemently deny, no, I'm not disabled. I'm just like, you know, obviously that's not true. You know, I was very obviously disabled, both by, you know, medical ways, also socially. So anyway, I was so confident. And then as time went on, I realized, oh, people are treating me differently. I guess I should start being weird. And then you get into like the masking and stuff. But then I started having less real friendships, and I started having less people accept me for really who I was, because I would just be a novelty at first. And then 6 months later, when they started, you know, realizing, okay, well, this never really fades, this is really her, then they wouldn't even like me, where that never happened at the beginning when I was just confidently who I was. And so it's really interesting to have the experience start when you're 20 years old already or 21 years old already, and you have the brain, you have a higher comprehension than like a two-year-old going through the same kind of experiences of learning, oh, I have to be this certain way in certain times, and I have to say please and thank you at these times, and I have to not touch people's things in these situations. And I'm learning all of those things, but as a 20-year-old. And so all of the masking and hiding disabilities and things like that came in a few years later. And all of this is me kind of returning back to who I was right after the brain injury and saying, screw this. I had the best life. I had the best friends. I had people accept me the most. I had people support me the most when I was unapologetically myself, because I didn't know it should have been hidden, because it shouldn't be hidden, you know? And so the outcomes that I've experienced is confidence. And also helping other people be confident in who they are. And I always thought that it was a side effect of autism to be really confident and unapologetically who you are and not caring. And I have learned that it's very much not the case. For some people, it can be that way. But for very, very, very many, it's the exact opposite. And kind of a big lack of confidence and an anxiety around human interactions. And so I learned that's not just a side effect of autism. That's a side effect of how I was raised and how I was accepted. And I want to give that to other people. So
I'm just really curious, because I had something really similar. When I was younger, I was like unapologetically myself, and constantly the world was like, stop being this. But I was doing fine. It wasn't until I started like trying to mask and starting to fit in and trying to like be more like people that I lost my confidence, that I lost my ability to speak up for what my needs were. And now doing something similar to you, trying to come full circle, reiterate like what my needs are, what's important so that I can be as successful and as vibrant and confident as I used to be before I started like masking to fit in.
Yeah.
It's hard. So hard. So Sam, do you have anything? I want to make sure that I didn't cut you off.
I mean, I've just been thinking about that and sort of, I mean, it's the old fallacy that, right, we should try to fit in and appeal to everyone as opposed to just be who we are and be best friends with the seven people who really fit with us, right? I don't know. I think there's something there. But I mean, obviously it's not the experience I'm going to have, because I don't really have the option to. I mean, I guess I could decide not to use a cane, but then the walking into walls would make it pretty obvious.
And before we get to our next question, we're going to hear from our sponsor.
Hi, my name is Cindy, and I'm a magnification and screen reader user. I'm a member of Fable's community of accessibility testers. If you're listening to this podcast, then you already know just how important it is to integrate the voices of people with disabilities into every aspect of your product development journey, and Fable can help you do that. From improving your team's accessibility training with Fable Upskill to working directly with assistive technology users with Fable Engage, we can help you take the next steps in building an amazing website and apps that are accessible and easy to use for everyone. To learn more, check out what we do at www.makeitfable.com and follow us on LinkedIn and Twitter.
And we're back.
That really brings us into kind of the next question, which is around community, right? Because you eventually came to accept your identity as a person with a disability and identify as disabled and realize like that's not something to fight against or be ashamed of or a bad word. And there's community in that. Did you feel like you found your people and joined a community, or did you feel like you had to build a space for you to be sort of from the ground up? And what was that sort of process like?
That is another really good question. I think that I had to build it from the ground up. But for me, the disabled community actually has been very not as welcoming as I would have thought and as it is for some other people. And for me, I have not found as much acceptance. And I think a lot of it is because, and no fault to anybody, really, we're all trying to find our space and where we fit. And a lot of that is coming up with defining how I fit in the disabled community. This is my experience, and forgetting that other people can have equally valid but opposite experiences, you know, and you kind of just alluded to one, which is apparent disabilities and non-apparent disabilities, you know, and I can hide mine if I want. I don't have to say that I'm disabled. I don't have to say that I have seizures. I mean, I'm a little bit weird, but people they're not going to think, oh, disabled, you know, and some people, obviously, if you're blind, if you're in a wheelchair, if you have a limb difference, if, you know, a lot of things that you can't hide it. So then I see that I've had some people not be as welcoming because I'm not visibly disabled. But then I see people who are non-visibly disabled be not as welcoming to, you know, people who are. And so I think it's silly because while something that's hard for me might be having to prove that I actually have the needs that I have, you know, because a lot of people don't believe that I'm disabled. When I go with my service dog to a store, you know, and I look completely capable and, you know, they're denying it and I have to prove my need. But I also, when I talk to people who have very visible disabilities, they're trying to prove their capabilities, you know, so I'm trying to prove that I actually have valid needs. And then other people are, you know, where it's visible, they're trying to prove that they actually have capabilities and are intelligent or are capable or you know, can function on their own in ways that people assume they can't. And so they might be different, but one is not better than the other. One is not worse than the other. And so that's one example. But in the autistic community, I haven't found a lot because of on LinkedIn, I have a lot of really good connections. We have really good conversations. And on LinkedIn, I do. But when it comes to real life, I find that either my brand of autism is too much for other autistic people, where they think that I've literally been told that I'm dramatizing certain of my autistic characteristics to seem more autistic, and just because it's more than theirs is in that way, and it's not faking at all. And I'm even getting so uncomfortable even talking about this because this feels I don't like saying that it was unwelcome for me, because I know that it's such a welcoming community for a lot of people, but this is my experience. And this is also a big reason why on LinkedIn, sometimes you'll see me talk about why like neurodivergence is not just autism and ADHD and the digestible versions of it. And it's not even just the pretty sides of autism. You know, there's meltdowns and there's big things that, like, somebody who's autistic can do something that's a really negative thing that is directly because of their autism, but we don't talk about that. And if I do, then, oh, you're wrong for painting people with autism in this way. And I was like, I'm not painting them this way. I'm just speaking one aspect of it, but get kind of shut down for time. So I don't know. I think every community can be non-welcoming in certain ways, and the disability community is no different.
Mm. Yeah. And I mean, there's the idea that whether you're blind or autistic, you're supposed to be like inspiring. And yeah, there's that. I mean, do you think some of it comes out of the fear? I mean, it's interesting how much this episode has focused around needs, but the thing that I've noticed, and I wonder if it accords with your experiences, is that when you as a person with a disability meet someone with needs different than yours, sometimes you can become afraid that, like, oh, if the limited accessibility resources are spent meeting their needs, then my needs won't be met, right? And maybe and sometimes we get sold into this sort of fake, like we can't all have our needs met, and so the pie has to be divided. Like, sometimes that feels like it's a force at play for me, right? Do you think that's maybe, I don't know, is that something you've experienced?
I have been nodding the entire time while you've been talking, because yes, I absolutely agree with that. And I don't think it's obviously there. It's not the one reason. There's not only one reason for anything, and especially this, but I do think that it's a very big one. And I think that, so I once went to, okay, two things. One, in specifically the autism community and or neurodivergent or anything like that, a lot of times there's people who say, well, obviously, you have a high paying job. I've done well in the corporate world. I've been paid very well. And they're like, obviously, if you could do that, then you don't need a lot of support. What they have no idea is that the more that I mask, the more seizures that I have at night because of the stress that it puts on my body, the more that I, and then when I have seizures, I pee my bed and then I have to clean my bed, and that puts more stress. And then on a brain that already can't handle a whole lot as other people can. And now you're adding tasks like cleaning your bed, washing your sheets regularly because, you know, you had a seizure last night. And all of these things that people don't think about, but also just because I'm able, I think I'm very, very privileged because my autistic traits are such that they're very beneficial in the corporate world, and not everybody's are. And so I am very privileged in that way, but it doesn't mean that the negative things to it are any less hard for me, or even equally hard. And maybe in some ways they're more hard, but we're not comparing. And if we're comparing, that's already wrong. But also, outside of just the neurodivergent piece, I once went with my mom to a concert about, I think, like last year. It was outdoors. I hadn't been to a concert in years because loud sounds, you know, lights, seizures. I hadn't gone, but I love concerts. But there was this one, it was outdoors. It was a couple hours away from where my parents live, and I was going to go. I was visiting them at the time, so I was going to go with her. And I go, and I scope out the outdoor, you know, kind of space first, and I get so excited when I see ADA seating. Get so excited when I see, you know, seating specifically for people with disabilities. And so I sit there, and I have my dog. He's not in a service vest or anything. It was really hot. It was summer. He's a big dog. I don't make him wear it. It's not required in the United States to have it. I don't make him wear it in these kind of situations when he's going to be outside and hot. And anyway, he wasn't wearing it. He doesn't have to. But I was approached, and the guy, you know, was like, you can't sit here. And I said, oh, well, I see it's ADA seating. I am disabled. And he's like, no, it's just for, like, if you're in a wheelchair, if you're blind. And because here's where this is wheelchair seating, and we're going to have interpreters up here. And I was like, well, I may not be in a wheelchair blind, but the seating, you know, if it's ADA seating, then that, you know, that includes me. Anyway, I go back and forth for a while, but then I just get so frustrated that I leave. I go back to the hotel where my mom was, and I'm like in tears, and I was like, I'm ready to go. And she's like, no, Julie, we're not going. You're so excited about this. Because she knew how excited I was to go to this. I'm a grown-ass woman. I'm like 30 years old, you know, ready to do this. And I'm just like, nope, this, I don't want to. So my mom, what does my mom do? I'm a grown woman. But my mom, she, and this isn't even normal her, but she goes and she advocates for me to this guy. And she's like, where was it? And where was he? And then she calls me a little bit later. And I was like, I don't care, Mom. You can do whatever you want, but I'm not going. I'm not going. I don't want to put up with this. I don't want to deal with it. I'm sick of advocating for myself, because sometimes it's just exhausting. You know, you just, it's not that you're giving up, but you just need to take a break from it. And so she calls me and she says, okay, it's okay. You can sit here. You know, they're not going to do anything wrong. We can all sit here, come back. So anyway, I end up going there, and it was fine. And they apologized to me, and my mom told me that she was like, I told them they had to apologize to you. They better come back and say, you know, they're sorry at how they treated you. And then they to my mom said, you know, we didn't realize any of this. This will help make a lot of our processes better. We're so grateful that you, you know, did this, and we're so happy to learn. But what people don't realize is that, like, that comes at the expense of me and my mental. Anyway, okay, that's a little bit off topic. So why I said this is because if I were to sit on the grass with everybody else, what if I had a seizure in the middle of it? It would have been really disruptive. Everyone would have been like, it would have been unsafe for me. It would have been unsafe for others. Like, a lot of bad things could have happened if I was in the middle and had a seizure there, you know? or if I needed to leave and I wasn't allowed to leave because you're whatever, all different reasons. But having out where I got to sit at a little table, or I sat on the floor for a lot of it, sat on the ground for a lot of it, but it was outside. It was a safer place where I could easily leave if I needed to, where people could easily get to me if they needed to. It was a much better situation, but because I wasn't visibly disabled and specifically in these ways, blind or in a wheelchair, I was viewed as non-worthy of these. My needs were not worthy of getting met in this way. And so I think...
Right. And it seemed like they were afraid that, like, oh, well, she's here, then someone with a wheelchair won't be able to be here, right?
Yep. And my answer to that was, well, then get more spaces then. This uh-huh, isn't my problem. Uh-huh. You figure out more spaces. We're outdoors, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, right. It almost never happens either.
Right, right.
I mean, the way it works in Canada here is I have a handicap parking permit that I carry along with me. And when someone's driving me, they park in handicap because I have a cane and mm-hmm. I can't walk like independently across the parking lot. It's not safe. It's not light controlled. But I get so much crap for parking in those spots because they're the wide spots that have the lift, right, for the wheelchairs. And like, I have never in my life, as far as I'm aware, parked somewhere and then had a person with a wheelchair need to be there. And I was like taking up the space because it's not. Yeah, I don't know. It's just interesting.
It's hard. This is why we shouldn't have such a scarcity situation, why we shouldn't all have to fight for our needs so hard. We should just, how do we build this world in which, you know, we don't have to all be fighting for resources? You know, it's.
I think viewing it also, sometimes, yes, we're fighting for resources, but most of the time we're not. And that's something that we've been told. I think most of the time we're not. And even, and there's always other solutions. And so even if a resource isn't created right now to accommodate another person in a wheelchair or something, well, then we'll freaking figure something out, you know, like. We can in that moment figure something out. And a lot of times we can't in that moment. It'll be the next moment, but we can learn from it. But a lot of times it's not as scarce as we think, mm-hmm. except people's willingness to provide and fulfill the need. The scarcity, that's what the real scarcity is, people being willing to fulfill the need and meet the need.
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, maybe the ultimate question is how do we convince the wider disability community to fight together instead of fighting each other, right?
Yes, exactly. Mm. Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. That's a huge thing that I've realized. I mostly live on LinkedIn and have some real world things, but most of my interactions are on LinkedIn. But that is something that I talk about not a whole lot because it's not my biggest focus, but I do sometimes I feel really inclined to focus on that. And why are we fighting against each other? And why are we not supporting other groups? Like, I am fair-skinned white. I have that privilege. There's a lot of autism that's completely focused on that, you know? But there are Black women who are autistic. There are so many other people who are autistic who don't have as much publicity as we do. So why aren't we also not only not fighting, but like, let's, I don't know, I think, well, I have a lot of thoughts, but I want to stop for right now.
I would love to transition us to along your journey. Has there been anything you've discovered that surprised you?
I think probably the biggest thing that surprised me was that how did I even see that the world that I thought that I needed to change for the world when right after my brain injury was the most accepted I've ever been ever. And still to this day, I would say are some of my favorite friends, my favorite relationships, my favorite experiences. And that's when my specific brand of disabilities were the worst, you know, I was having more seizures than ever. And it's funny that sometimes we can let insecurities or some of the negatives overcloud a lot of the great things that are happening. And what I learned is that I'm more accepted by not masking. I'm more accepted by not hiding who I am. I'm more accepted by being unapologetically me. And sure, some people are going to not like it, but it just matters so much less when you're not trying to make them like you. And there are people who do like you, you know? I think that was probably the most surprising thing. Except, why was it even surprising? Because it was evidenced right there at the beginning, but, you know, still surprising somehow.
It's really interesting you talk about like being in the hospital. The most calm and in control of my life and the least biggest time that I ever learned was when I was in a wheelchair for 4 months and pretty much confined to bed. People would ask what I needed, but like I was able to just like read books and have no pressure on me to do a bunch of things that I didn't realize like build up these external pressures of present yourself this way, do this thing, like actually just not having to make any excuses for anything and just be able to do what I want was like literally the biggest time of growth in my entire life was those 4 months, just being able to read what I want, learn about what I want, have enough time and space. And this is pre-smartphones and Netflix has happened. And so I just unencumbered time to like read. And I read my books on tape. So I went to the library and got like a ton of books on tape. I don't know. It's fascinating because like I feel like I'm just seeking that now. I'm just like, how do I find this time and space to get back to that moment? I just took us way off topic.
But now you've made me super interested. And as somebody who, you know, despite being blind, is very neurotypical. I mean, it's interesting that you mentioned that was before smartphones. Have we broken the world in a way? Like, Julia, I know you said you live on LinkedIn. And I mean, if you were sick in bed every day today, would you still be like expected to be on smartphone and on LinkedIn and on the internet and feeling and doing that pressure in a way that maybe 20 years ago wasn't a thing? And so, I mean, the smartphones have made things so much better for, you know, me, because I have a screen reader now. But like, sometimes I wonder, have we made things worse for some disabilities with the advent of technology? I don't know.
I think that it's the increased expectations on humanity and on others that has changed it more than the technology itself, because the technology is as enabling as anything that we've ever had in the world, you know? Mm. However, does it come with increased expectation? Like when I text you, I expect you to respond. I saw you posting on LinkedIn. Do I expect you to be there every day? And here is the key, I think, to individuals, disabled or not, but especially people with disabilities who already have, you know, kind of a higher, have to do more in life just to live, you know. Mm-hmm. I think that it's not allowing other people's expectations to become your own expectations of yourself, and not to let other people's expectations become what you judge yourself by and how you. I don't post on LinkedIn every day. Sometimes I can for 3 weeks straight. And then sometimes I go 3 weeks straight without posting at all. And guess what? Nothing bad happens. And some people might judge me for it. I don't know. I genuinely don't know though, because I don't care and I don't allow it into my space. And if it comes and somebody makes a comment about it, I just say, oh yeah, well, I didn't feel like it. And my answer, like that's a good enough answer. And I think at the beginning, I don't even remember when I was answering, but I said, I kind of do what I want when I want. And that's what I do. And that's true for almost anything. And that's my answer to almost anything. And I wish that everyone could kind of get that freedom in their mind to just say, well, because I didn't want to, or because I did want to, and let that be enough and not let society's expectations and the expectations that come with more technology and the, you know, well, you have more technology now, you should be able to do more. Well, you have the screen reader. Nothing should be holding you back. Why aren't you just as fast as everyone else? Why are you faster? Why are you slower today than you were yesterday? Is your whatever working still? Like, it's not all about technology. And just because we have working technology doesn't mean we have to still be, we're not robots, you know, just because our technology is. And so.
Yeah. And maybe even learning to fight back against the expectations of the technology itself. Right.
Yes. Well, yes.
Yep. I think that's such a good call out that it's been an increase of expectations. I haven't really heard it framed that way, but I really relate to what you're saying. I think that's why I felt so relieved while I was in bed reading, was the expectations were gone. It really was the removal of expectations. So we're coming really close to the end. This has been so wonderful to talk with you, Julie. So I would love to learn, what do you feel are some small ways people can start towards a path of inclusion, accessibility, furthering the rights of people with disabilities, and so on?
like much of the focus of this episode, needs. I think so much starts with needs and accepting people's needs, whether you understand them or not, and accepting people's needs and filling them in ways that you can, whether you think they're valid or not. It's not your place to think they're valid or not, you know? And I think I personally think that if that changed, then so many things just fall in place after that, you know, whether just accept people's needs for what they are and fulfill them. And then obviously, like, bare minimum, be in legal compliance at the very bare minimum, but pay attention to people's needs and just grant them.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And so as we move toward the end, if folks need or want to find you, where can they find you and keep up with what you're doing? And is there anything you would like to plug?
Okay, back to the previous question really fast.
Sure.
Also, I find that people are able to better respect other people's needs when they start respecting their own needs and respect. I know probably your whole life you've been told you can't need this. You're too needy for needing this. You shouldn't ask for this. Do you really need it this time? You were okay yesterday. Why do you need it today? And you learn to not even respect your own needs. So I guess really the first step is to respect your own needs, identify your own needs, give yourself your own needs, advocate for your own needs. And then you'll start doing that to others naturally, but also you can start focusing more on that. And then that kind of goes into what I do and kind of how I support individuals. And I have a program that helps kind of you learn how to identify your needs. And some people's needs are very obvious and they've known them since birth. Some how they need to get their needs met, they haven't identified that necessarily. So help with that. You can find me on LinkedIn. I mean, maybe I should have come prepared with like my URL and stuff, but it's just, if you search Julie Harris Disability on LinkedIn, I'm pretty sure that I'll pop up and be the first one.
We'll get it in the show notes.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you so much for being here. This was so awesome talking to you.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks for listening to Disability Bandwidth. If you like this episode of Disability Bandwidth, please subscribe and share it with friends and family. Today's episode was hosted by Sam Prue and Nikki Nolan. Edited and produced by Nikki Nolan. Transcripts are written by Emma Klauber. Theme music is created by F.A. Ackman. Special thanks to everyone at Fable who, without their support, this show would not be possible. You can find out more about Disability Bandwidth on Twitter and Instagram @DisabilityBandwidth or on our website at disabilitybandwidth.com.